This is your weekly checkup with Howard Feldman and Dr. Anton Myberg, where medical innovation meets human understanding.
Good evening and welcome to the weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. Tonight, we're talking about one of the world's deadliest diseases, and that is malaria. For many of us, malaria feels like something that only affects remote tropical regions. But every year, it infects hundreds of millions of people and claims hundreds of thousands of lives, most of them in Africa. Malaria is also just one of a number of tropical diseases, including bilharzia, typhoid, cholera, yellow fever, tick bite fever, those that remain a significant global health threat, fueled by travel, by changing climates, and a shifting mosquito population. So, what happens when malaria enters the body? Why do some people recover quickly? And why do others become critically ill? What should you know before traveling to a high-risk area? Tonight, we'll unpack the science, the symptoms, the prevention, the treatment, and the myths surrounding these diseases. Because sometimes the greatest danger comes from the smallest bite. Yeah, we need some music there. I'm Howard Feldman in studio. Dr. Anton Myberg, hope you're well.
Good evening. It's been far too long. Said no one ever.
Said nobody ever, especially when we're talking about tropical diseases. What exactly is a tropical disease?
So tropical diseases actually are infectious and parasitic illnesses that are uniquely prevalent in or entirely exclusive to tropical and subtropical regions. So their concentration is heavily influenced by climate, thriving in warm, humid environments that allow insect vectors like mosquitoes to breed year-round, and socioeconomic factors like limited access to healthcare and sanitation affect them. So if you've got what we call vector-borne transmission, the majority of these infections are spread through the bites of insects or parasites like mosquitoes or tsetse flies, rather than direct human-to-human transmission. There's a socioeconomic link, and that's essentially affected by impoverished and marginalized communities, trapping them in cycles of chronic illness. And there's a global reach where these diseases are concentrated near the equator, but they spread globally through international travel, migration, and trade. And common examples of these are malaria, which is a life-threatening blood disease caused by parasites transmitted by an infected Anopheles mosquito, or dengue fever, which is a painful mosquito-borne viral illness that causes flu-like symptoms and severe joint pain. Other ones are yellow fever, which is a serious viral disease transmitted by mosquitoes, and that can cause jaundice and hemorrhagic fever. And lastly, African trypanosomiasis, which is known as sleeping sickness. And that's a parasitic disease which is spread by the tsetse fly that can affect your nervous system. Now, there's also another side to it, because lest they be forgotten, we call them the neglected tropical diseases.
Oh, gosh. Even tropical diseases need to have self-esteem.
So that's a subset of these illnesses. And that includes things like leprosy, trachoma, and schistosomiasis. And these thrive in areas lacking clean water and adequate sanitation. And they essentially affect over 1 billion people globally.
What is that other one? That's a name I can't pronounce. I left it out in my intro.
Schistosomiasis.
No, man. Anyone can say schistosomiasis. What about
dengue fever.
What's it called?
Dengue fever.
Dengue. Yes. Oh, okay. Because you spell it funny. So I just wasn't sure. Fine. Okay. So tropical climates are ideal. And mosquitoes seem to be the spread of the many illnesses.
So yeah, I mean, mosquitoes are incredibly effective at spreading diseases because their feeding habits allow them to infect or inject these pathogens directly into the bloodstream of their hosts. Female mosquitoes require blood to develop their eggs, and they frequently bite multiple hosts, easily picking up and transmitting viruses and parasites. So it's through direct blood injection. When a mosquito bites an infected person or animal, it ingests pathogens together with the blood. These germs then incubate and multiply inside the mosquito before it migrates to the mosquito's salivary glands. When the mosquito then bites its next victim, it injects saliva containing these pathogens straight into the new host bloodstream, which is generally the human that we know about. Now, no mosquito is harmed in this practice, but the pathogens themselves allow the insect to become a long-term carrier, and they effectively infect new hosts every time it feeds for the rest of its life. So there's a high mobility. Mosquitoes can travel miles to find a blood meal. And because they are so mobile and move in massive populations, they can actually spread illnesses rapidly across large geographic areas. And then certain species, we get an Aedes aegypti, which spreads dengue, yellow fever, and Zika. We get Anopheles, which spreads malaria as we know it, have evolved to live in close proximity to humans and have developed a strong preference for human blood. And with global travel and climate, there's rapidly allowing the diseases to be carried to move across borders. And then you get introduction of these pathogens to new areas where local mosquitoes can then spread them. And of course, warmer temperatures create these ideal breeding environments and expand this geographic reach of the insects.
So, and why tropical climates?
Well, tropical climates can help actually breed the disease vectors for the mosquitoes, because you see, when you've got a very warm temperature and high humidity, it then will accelerate the life cycle and breeding of the disease vector, the mosquito. So these conditions then allow those pathogens to incubate quicker. And then you get heavy seasonal rains, which create a stagnation of water that serves as your perfect breeding ground for these insects.
Okay. So mosquito malaria itself, what is malaria and how does it spread?
So malaria, if we want to say in one sentence, it's a life-threatening but curable disease caused by parasites.
Okay.
It's almost exclusively spread by the bites of infected female Anopheles mosquitoes. So as you said, when the mosquito bites, it injects that parasite into your bloodstream, where it then travels to your liver, multiplies, and destroys red blood cells. And the transmission cycle requires both a human and a mosquito. So the infected female Anopheles mosquito bites a healthy person and then injects the parasites through her saliva. Once the mosquito bites that infected person, ingesting the parasite along with the blood, the parasite then matures inside that mosquito for 10 to 14 days, making it capable of infecting the next person it bites. So the parasite itself lives then in red blood cells. Therefore, it also can occasionally spread through blood transfusions and organ transplants or shared needles. However, this is far more rare. But important thing to understand is malaria is not contagious. It's not transmitted from human to human like the cold or flu. It cannot spread through casual contact, through hugging or sexual activity. The symptoms which you find with malaria typically appear after about 2 weeks, 10 to 15 days after infected bite, but can even take up to a year to develop. And signs and symptoms can be like mild and flu-like. So high fever, shaking, chills, rigors, severe headaches, muscle aches, sweats, fatigue, vomiting, and diarrhea. And if left untreated, especially the one we call Plasmodium falciparum, the malaria can become severely fatal within 24 hours.
24 hours?
Yeah. So we've got to say that malaria is a preventable disease. So if you're traveling to a tropical or subtropical region, then you can protect yourself by using insect repellent, wearing protective clothing, sleeping under insecticide-treated nets, and having preventative antimalarials.
Wow. Okay. When we come back, I wanted to talk about yellow fever and dengue fever, because those appear to be increasing globally. This is a pre-record, but feel free to send your questions and your comments through to 061-895-1019. This is the Weekly Checkup with me and Dr. Anton Meiberg.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Welcome back to the Weekly Checkup. We are talking about malaria. We're talking about tropical diseases. And we'll talk a little bit more about malaria prevention, treatment a little bit later. But I want to move on to understand things like dengue fever as well as yellow fever, because from what I'm understanding, there seems to have been an increase globally.
So it's true, because these diseases like dengue and yellow fever spread globally because of rapid unplanned urbanization. So that creates ideal breeding grounds for mosquitoes. Also, climate change expands the mosquitoes' habitats, and there's increased international travel, which accelerates the spread of pathogens, as well as lagging vaccination coverage, which leaves populations vulnerable. So if you have unplanned urbanization, then you have a growth of dense, unplanned cities in tropical regions. And then you get abundant standing water in discarded tires, plastic containers, clogged gutters. And that fuels the urban proliferation of something called the Aedes mosquito. With climate change, warmer global temperatures, altered rainfall patterns. These expand the geographic range of mosquito vectors and speed up the viral incubation period inside the mosquito, which increases the transmission rates. You have international travel and the movement of people and goods rapidly transport these viruses from endemic regions to previously uninfected areas. And then, of course, you've got gaps in immunity and vaccination. So for yellow fever, suboptimal vaccination coverage across parts of Africa and some of the Americas allows new outbreaks to emerge in the under-immunized communities. For dengue fever, there's no universal vaccine. So people living in endemic zones remain vulnerable to multiple distinct strains. And of course, we get something called deforestation encroachment. So with humans expanding into previously undisturbed forest environments, this increases the risk of spillover events. So humans encounter what we call sylvatic or forest-dwelling mosquitoes that actually were naturally circulating the virus amongst primates.
So just explain this to me. Let's say somebody's in a tropical area. There are malaria carrying or yellow fever carrying mosquitoes. We board a plane or a car, and one of the mosquitoes comes with us. Does that mean that this is going to spread malaria to wherever we're flying?
So potentially. So if that mosquito survives, we get what we call an Odyssean malaria, which is a travel-related malaria, because you've actually transferred that mosquito, which is already carrying the pathogen inside its salivary glands, which can spread it to other people.
Wow. Okay. So that is quite scary in a way. But I mean, I suppose it's a very low chance of that mosquito then infecting somebody and then spreading from person to person.
Well, you can't spread to person to person. Remember, it's a mosquito that spreads it itself. So if that mosquito survives long enough, it can then spread.
Okay, fine. So it's only that mosquito, right? I got it.
That female mosquito.
Don't make me say it. Do not make me say it. Okay, so you've spoken about also how climate change, global travel affects it. But why is it that tropical diseases are still so much of a global health problem? Because, I mean, we've got yellow fever's got a vaccine. Malaria's got treatment. Why is it that it's still such a problem?
So I think there's a intersection of your climate change, your socioeconomic disparities and biological resilience. And these factors allow for all of these different parasites, et cetera, to thrive and spread and evade these eradication efforts. So as we said, rising global temperatures, shifting rainfall patterns, these expand the geographic range of these disease-carrying vectors, poverty, infrastructure, lack of basic sanitation, clean water, adequate housing. These are ideal breeding grounds for pathogens. And then we get something called biological adaptation, where many of these tropical parasites and viruses have a very high mutation rate, and that leads to an increased resistance against established drugs and insecticides. And of course, don't forget our little friends, the neglected tropical diseases. They receive a lot less pharmaceutical investment compared to conditions which are prevalent in the wealthy nations. So therefore, there's a shortage of new vaccines and therapeutics.
That's actually terrible. Really, really terrible. Right. Let's now focus on malaria itself, because malaria, from what I'm understanding, is the biggest threat. 061-895-1019. Send us your questions. Send us your comments. As I said, this is a pre-record of the weekly checkup, but we always look at the questions and we'll get back to you should there be anything that we need to address. What happens inside the body during malaria?
So during a typical malaria infection, the Plasmodium parasite systematically will destroy red blood cells and therefore alter your blood circulation. That then lands at depriving your vital organs of oxygen and triggers a severe cyclical immune response. So it starts off with what we call the silent invasion. We call that the liver stage. You get an infiltration, your infected female Anopheles mosquito bites a human. It then injects the parasite into the bloodstream. It then migrates. The parasite travels directly to the liver within minutes, and you get that silent replication. So they invade the liver cells and they multiply rapidly for about 7 to 10 days without causing any physical symptoms or illness. Certain ones, like you get a Plasmodium vivax and a Plasmodium ovale, they can actually leave dormant forms. which are called hypnozites in the liver, and they can only wake up months or years later to cause a relapse.
Wow.
So that's stage one. Stage two is then a destruction of your red blood cells. That's the blood stage. So we start off the liver stage, then we go to the blood stage. During the blood stage is a cell takeover. So thousands of new parasites burst out of the liver and invade your healthy red blood cells. The parasites then consume these cells, and they consume the hemoglobin. That's the protein that carries oxygen to fuel their growth. And you get a synchronized bursting. So every 48 to 72 hours, those infected red blood cells rupture simultaneously, and they release a new wave of parasites in the blood. And due to all of this, you get an explosive cellular destruction, which dumps parasites, which are waste products, and toxins into your bloodstream. And the immune system responds with intense inflammatory sparks. So you get that signature cyclical pattern of severe chills, shaking, high fever, and profuse sweating. Your next step is what we call cellular changes and blood vessel clogging. So the parasite then forces that infected red blood cell to lose its natural flexibility, and it makes those blood cells stiff and fragile. This leads to something called stickiness. The parasites push sticky proteins to the surface of the blood cells and cause the blood cells to clump together and anchor to the internal walls of small blood vessels. And then you get microclogging. So once it does this, these vessels stick to the wall, these blood vessels stick to the blood vessel walls, and the parasites are unable to be filtered out and killed then by the spleen. So then you get blockages that choke off normal blood flow. And that's when your systemic strain and severe complications occur, because the infection progresses without treatment. There's blocking of blood vessels, loss of healthy red blood cells, and that damages your critical organs. So you can get a severe, severe anemia, where you get massive destruction of your red blood cells, and that destroys your body's ability to destroy to distribute oxygen, leading to extreme fatigue and suffocation. And then you get something called cerebral malaria, where those sticky blood cells clog the tiny capillaries inside the brain, and that cuts off oxygen delivery, causing brain swelling, seizures, confusion, coma. Organ failure then develops, with toxins and hemoglobin overloading and shut down the kidneys, and then fluid builds up into the lungs. You go into a condition called pulmonary edema, making it very difficult to breathe. Your liver and spleen swell significantly because they're working overtime to try and get rid of these cellular debris. And then you get a metabolic crisis. So the infection can often cause a crash in your blood sugar levels, causes a hypoglycemia and accumulation of acid in the blood, both of which can be extremely fatal.
Wow. I actually feel like I need to lie down after that. But just tell me, why can malaria become life-threatening so quickly then?
As I said, malaria can actually become life-threatening within 24 hours, because these parasites multiply exponentially in your bloodstream, and they continue to destroy and break down those red blood cells and block small blood vessels. So it's driven by this, the most common and deadly species, which is Plasmodium falciparum. And you get massive red blood cell destruction. So the parasite invades, multiplies within, and bursts these red blood cells every 48 hours, causing a rapid drop in hemoglobin, leading to life-threatening severe anemia. And we get patients to come in and present to us with a hemoglobin of 6, knowing that a normal hemoglobin is about 13 to 14. They're short of breath, they're anemic, they present in heart failure.
So I wanted to ask you about that, because, I mean, we'll talk about the early symptoms in a minute, but is malaria on your radar? In other words, somebody comes in and they're presenting with those things. It could be one of a dozen of reasons why they have a low iron, why they have shortness of breath.
That's why you've got to have a very good clinical history. So when someone presents with a fever of unknown origin, you always ask them, have you traveled anywhere? Mm. Travel history plays a very significant part in this. Have you been to the Kruger? Have you been to the Americas? Have you been to Asia? These things are very big, you know, sort of factors that make us suspicious of what's going on.
Because, I mean, at times it's so easy to say, oh, well, you've got a fever, it must be flu or a virus. But we're going to talk about that in a moment. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Marburg, talking about malaria and other wonderful tropical diseases. We'll be back just after this.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Welcome back to the weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Marburg. Send us your questions, your comments, 061-895-1019. This is a pre-record, but we'll be checking messages and coming back to you if need be. Right. We were talking before the break, we were talking about when patients present the symptoms, how you look at it, why you start to consider malaria. What are the early symptoms that, never mind the doctors, but what can patients consider?
So patients with a general travel history, they can present with symptoms 7 to 30 days after an infected mosquito bite. And these symptoms can closely resemble the flu. So you can present with a sudden high fever, intense chills, shivering, profuse sweating, throbbing headaches, muscle and joint pain. And these symptoms are very cyclical. In other words, they manifest as attacks that start with shivering, they progress to intense heat, and then they finish with sweating and exhaustion. So you get a sudden onset of a high temperature, which is then accompanied by intense, uncontrollable shivering, profuse sweating, severe body aches, nausea, and vomiting. And those things can be the start of malaria, but if you develop difficulty breathing, confusion, seizures, yelling in the eyes or skin like a jaundice or dark or urine or severe anemia, you have to seek immediate medical help.
Okay, now this part freaks me out whenever I hear about cerebral malaria. What is it?
That's typically called brain malaria, cerebral malaria, and that's the most severe and life-threatening complication of the Plasmodium falciparum infection.
So it's a complication.
Yeah,
it's not spread. Its own strain of malaria.
No, so it's a complication
of
the malaria.
That's good to clarify.
So that occurs when that parasite-infected red blood cells clog the small blood vessels in the brain, causing inflammation. They disrupt the blood-brain barrier and cause dangerous neurological symptoms. And it's generally defined as an unarousable coma that cannot be explained by any other cause. In other words, it's not explained by meningitis. It's not explained by hypoglycemia, low sugar. And the classic signs include extreme confusion, drowsiness, irritability, in other words, an altered mental state, unarousable coma when you actually have an inability to wake up or appropriately respond to painful stimuli, neurological events, which include seizures and convulsions, or abnormal posturing, like rigid body movements or abnormal eye positions. And as we said, it's extensively triggered by the Plasmodium falciparum parasite, which causes cytoadhesion. So then instead of actually circulating, those red blood cells become extremely sticky and they stick to the walls of the tiny blood vessels in the brain. That itself causes vascular blockage and swelling, and it clogs the blood flow, depriving the brain tissue of oxygen and causing the brain to swell. And that blockage results in an inflammatory response, which cracks the blood-brain barrier into timing hemorrhages in the brain tissue. This is what we as doctors call a medical emergency. It's an absolute medical emergency. And without prompt intravenous anti-malarial treatment, like things like artesunate, the condition is fatal. Mm. And there can be long-term effects, even with proper treatment. Mortality rates are about 10 to 20%.
Wow.
And even survivors are at a high risk for lasting neurological or cognitive deficits, including epilepsy, behavioral changes, partial paralysis. And that's why when I get asked, when people are going to Kruger, should I take anti-malarials during the summertime or during the rainy seasons? My answer is yes, yes, and yes.
Is cerebral malaria a time-based thing? In other words, untreated malaria, or does it follow its own journey at its own pace?
So not every malaria will turn into cerebral malaria.
Got it.
But some people, whether they might be immune-suppressed more than others, can develop the cerebral malaria. Depends on the female Anopheles mosquito, how virulent that one was.
Mm, mm. I noticed the emphasis on female mosquito. They're trying to find the way.
But cerebral period.
Yeah. Okay, why are children and pregnant women especially vulnerable?
Well, they both have got suppressed or immature immune systems, so they are less able to fight off that Plasmodium parasite. So, of course, they've got biological and physiological changes, which create severe and perfect conditions for severe infections, anemia, and these can lead to poor birth outcomes. So children under 5 years old haven't had enough exposure to build up a natural immunity to the parasite. Therefore, they're highly susceptible to both infection and severe complications. And in young children, that malaria can progress from a mild fever to life-threatening severe anemia or cerebral malaria in less than 24 hours. With regards to pregnant women, they've got a lowered immunity. And to prevent the body from rejecting the fetus, a woman's cellular immunity drops during pregnancy, and that makes her more susceptible to new infections and severe malaria episodes. So the Plasmodium falciparum parasites then can sequester, or what that's called hide, and multiply in the placenta, because it expresses unique proteins that the parasite binds to. And that causes what we call a placental malaria, which can lead to maternal anemia, miscarriages, premature deliveries, low birth weights. And due to the higher body temperatures and increased carbon dioxide emissions, pregnant women are more likely to be bitten by malaria-carrying Anopheles mosquitoes.
Wow. Why is that?
Well, that's because of the immunity. So they have a higher carbon dioxide.
No. But why?
Because it's almost like they've got a radar that syncs them to those levels.
Incredible. Wow. Okay. Which warning signs shouldn't be ignored?
Okay. So these are the things that can lead to things like cerebral malaria, organ failure, and that's an altered mental state with confusion, drowsiness, the neurological changes, seizures, convulsions, respiratory issues with difficulty in breathing, shortness of breath, extreme paleness, especially on the palms, the eyes, the gums, jaundice, yellowing of the skin, organ stress, where you get dark or bloody urine or possibly very little urine, persistent vomiting, and prolonged fever that does not react to standard medications or last longer than 48 hours.
Okay. And rapid diagnosis. Do we have a way to rapidly diagnose?
We do. And it's the rapid diagnosis and treatment are critical because we know that malaria parasites multiply quickly, sometimes every 48 hours, in the bloodstream. So, you know, the swift involvement intervention will prevent the flu-like symptoms from rapidly progressing to severe life-threatening complications. And rapid action stops disease progression. And you can stop that with prompt treatment with effective medications, such as what we call artemisinin-based combination. And that clears the parasite before it leads to severe malaria. We want to prevent fatal complications. So you want to, if you delay the treatment, you raise the risk of severe anemia, respiratory failure, kidney disease. And we need to protect the vulnerable groups like infants, pregnant women, and young children. And the rapid diagnostic tests, because your malaria symptoms are like a fever, headache, and chills, and they're extremely identical to common viral infections, then we're relying on clinical guesses to lead to misdiagnosis. So using a rapid diagnostic test with point-of-care testing, you can get a finger prick blood test which can deliver accurate results in about 15 to 20 minutes, even in remote rural areas without microscopes. Then you can have targeted therapy, and this also will prevent drug resistance.
Okay, when we come back, we are going to be talking about other tropical diseases, but let me know on 0618951019, would you recognize malaria symptoms in yourself or in your family? This is The Weekly Checkup. I'm Howard Feldman. We'll be back just after this.
High FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Welcome back to The Weekly Checkup with me, Howard Feldman, and Dr. Anton Marburg. Before we go on to other tropical diseases, I just want to make sure that we've covered the treatment for malaria.
So I think that's very important because with uncomplicated malaria, you need a three-day course of artemisinin, which is a based combination therapy where you get something like artemether and lumefantrine, which is a six-dose regimen over 3 days. For severe and complicated malaria, your first-line therapy is intravenous artesunate or alternatively intravenous quinine. And then, of course, malaria prophylaxis includes drugs like mefloquine, tovaquone, proguanate, and doxycycline. And those are very, very important. Otherwise, also non-drug treatments include netting, which is it's got a proper net over the bed that's tucked into the mattress, which has actually got medication in it. We call it DEET, which is a very, very thick medication that actually can prevent the malaria from replicating, as well as your tabards and things like that, and long sleeves when you go out at nighttime and things like that.
You haven't mentioned GNTs.
Well, GNTs are very important because they've got chloroquine in them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And we need
the
to have...
The tonic. It's not the G. It's
even
the
in Joburg.
The tonic has got the chloroquine in.
I know, but you can't have the tonic, the T without the G. So even in Joburg, you recommend like a few GNTs a day. Is that what you're saying? And no, he's not.
Going to the next topic.
Okay, let's move on to the next topic. No. Exactly. Okay, let's talk about other tropical diseases. This dengue fever, now that I've learned to pronounce it, but I've also heard it called breakbone fever. Is this true?
Yeah, so once again, that's a viral disease, and that's spread by the Aedes mosquito. And that's commonly called that breakbone fever because it causes intense, sudden joint muscle and bone pain that feels if your bones like feels like your bones are actually breaking. And that is caught from the bite of an infected mosquito, but it also doesn't spread from person to person. And you get high fever, severe headache, pain behind the eyes, rash, and the hallmark is severe bone and joint pain. And there are variants. So most cases are very mild and resolved within a week. Some cases can progress to severe dengue, what's called dengue hemorrhagic fever, which is life-threatening. And those are common in tropical and subtropical regions worldwide.
But we don't see them anywhere in our tropical areas, do we?
Even though the vector is found in parts of South Africa, we don't really see dengue hemorrhagic fever, luckily.
Oh, well, thank God for that, because I'd be hysterical. What is bilharzia and how do people get infected? I was petrified of bilharzia as a kid. I wouldn't swim in our swimming pool if the filter wasn't on because I was convinced I was going to get bilharzia.
And that's when it all starts.
It actually is, more or less. Okay, tell me about bilharzia.
So bilharzia, in medical terms, is called schistosomiasis. That's a disease caused by another parasite. It's called a parasitic blood fluke, which is a tiny worm that lives in fresh water. So it's one of the most common parasitic diseases in the world, and that affects tropical and subtropical regions across sub-Saharan Africa. So you get infected by coming into contact with contaminated fresh water, such as lakes, rivers, streams, and ponds. Notice I did not say swimming pools.
Okay.
You cannot catch it from another person, nor can you catch it in the ocean or in properly chlorinated swimming pools. Impossible to catch it from
okay.
that.
Okay. Now you tell me.
So the cycle of the infection, the source is an infected person contaminates fresh water with urine or feces that contain parasite eggs. Then the snail, the eggs hatch, and the larvae infect specific freshwater snails, where they multiply and develop into the infective stage. And then these snails release tiny microscopic larvae back into the water. And then when you swim or bath or do your laundry in this infected or infested water, the larvae penetrate your skin and enter your bloodstream. And once inside your body, they migrate, these larvae migrate through your blood to the lungs and to the liver, where they grow into adult worms and settle near the bladder or in the intestines. And these adult worms lay eggs, which cause inflammation and organ damage as they travel through your body.
I'm just feeling nauseous.
So the common signs are what we call a skin rash or swimmer's itch, where the parasite is actually burrowed into the skin. And then early symptoms, like 1 to 2 months later, you get fevers, chills, cough, muscle aches, as the body reacts to the worm laying eggs. And long-term complications, if they're left untreated, those trapped eggs can cause chronic damage. You can have blood in your urine, you can have abdominal pain, liver spleen enlargement, and you can have reproductive tract complications. So, I mean, it's quite a serious disease if you're swimming in...
And is it a myth that it comes through the nail of your foot or hand?
Yeah, generally it burrows into the skin. You know what I'm saying? Okay. And I mean,
we have a lot of bilharzia in South Africa?
Yeah, it depends if the water is not safe to swim in. So if it's been affected or it's not fresh flowing water,
right.
You know, then you will get large amounts. Now, the treatment for bilharzia is something called praziquantel, and that kills...
Sounds like a G&T as well, or is it not?
Adult worm, no. So it actually inactivates against the immature worms, and therefore you need to have a follow-up dose 4 weeks later so that make the complete viral parasite ineffective.
I wonder if that's not where this whole idea, my late father always used to say that they were never allowed to go swimming in Pilgrim's Rest because they would swim in the rivers until after the first rains. And I wonder if it isn't because like the water would wash down the river. And interesting.
Yeah.
Let's talk about cholera, because I always think about cholera. I don't think about cholera as a tropical disease.
Yeah, so cholera is one of the very important things, because cholera is more of something where you get... It's due to basically a lack of access to safe drinking water, inadequate basic sanitation and hygiene. So your outbreaks generally cause an overwhelming of a fragile health system. So half of the world's population do not have safely managed water or sanitation. Mm. Therefore, they get contaminated food, contaminated water. When you have extreme climate change, extreme weather events like these floods or cyclones or droughts, this disrupts your water supplies. That displaces your communities, and then you get an ideal environment for this Vibrio cholerae bacteria to thrive. And it's a very big, big problem, because if you've got armed conflict, let's say, this destroys water treatment facilities. So they actually bomb the facilities, and then they force people into overcrowded facilities, and there's unsanitary displacement camps, allowing the disease to spread far quicker.
Interesting.
So the oral cholera vaccine is a vital tool, okay? It actually helps to keep these things at bay, but there's a struggle to keep the pace with the demand, okay?
So should everybody be having the cholera vaccine, or is there something really in specific areas?
Socioeconomic places where you've got no sort of sanitation and there's poor urbanization. But the treatment is essentially prompt rehydration. So oral rehydration salts, and they actually make, oral rehydration salts, okay? They actually make pre-packaged mixtures of sugar and salt mixed with clean water, which replaces lost water and electrolytes. If it's more serious, you get intravenous fluids and antibiotics for severe cases. For adults, you can give them doxycycline. For children, azithromycin. Children less than 5 years also benefit from getting zinc as well.
Talk about typhoid fever.
So typhoid fever is another one of the life-threatening infections, and that's caused by a bacteria called Salmonella typhi, okay? It spreads...
Salmonella is typhoid?
No, so that is... Salmonella is a foodborne illness.
Right.
This is a bacteria called Salmonella typhi, hence the typhoid. Okay? So this spreads almost exclusively through your fecal-oral route. In other words, it's contracted by ingesting food or drinking water, which is contaminated with the feces of urine of an infected person. So if you drink water that's contaminated by raw sewage, or eating food handled by someone who's carrying the bacteria without washing their hands properly. And humans are the only carriers of the Salmonella typhi. Even if they've recovered from the disease, they become chronic carriers, and they can harbor the bacteria in their gallbladder or their intestines and continue to shed in their feces for years without showing symptoms. And the problem is that with poor sanitation and hygiene, the disease thrives in areas lacking access to this clean water, proper sewage treatment, and adequate hand washing. So the difference between Salmonella typhi and Salmonella is Salmonella is a foodborne illness, which is itself also contaminated or transmitted through contaminated water or undercooked foods, example, chicken or beef or that type of thing. And there you present with diarrhea, fever, abdominal cramps, and also you have to replace lost fluids. But the prevention is washing hands with soap and water after handling raw foods and preparing food properly.
Wow. It is absolutely fascinating. We need to take a quick break. We'll be back soon after this. 061-895-1019. Send us your questions. Send us your comments. I'm Howard Feldman. This is The Weekly Checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg.
IFM 101.9 megahertz of life.
Welcome back to The Weekly Checkup with me and Dr. Anton Myberg. We're talking about malaria. We're talking about tropical diseases. And I want to talk about tick bite fever, because it apparently is quite common in South Africa, and apparently also is one of those under or misdiagnosed illnesses. Talk to me about that.
So tick bite fever is a bacterial infection, and that's spread by tick bites. So it can present with high fevers, headache, you get a spotted rash, you get a typical red sore on the skin and a dark necrotic area, which we call an SR. And the treatment of that is doxycycline. Its causes are something called rickettsia, okay? So there's two types, is rickettsia coenneri and rickettsia africae, okay? It's very common in South Africa due to climate, wildlife, agricultural practices. And it's missed a lot of times if a clinical assessment is not done and the patient is not examined properly to find these SRs. So a lot of people who go into the bush get bitten by a tick. If you don't find the area with a bit, you can find, because people come to hospital and you present it with a fever. We call it a pyrexia of unknown origin, a fever of unknown origin, if you can't find the cause. But generally, you can find the cause if you find an SR or this black necrotic area on the skin.
Yeah.
You get an involvement of your lymph nodes and you get this fever. And it's very easy to pick up once you know what you're looking for.
Wow. Okay. And is tick bite fever what the Americans call Lyme's disease?
No, Lyme's disease is a completely different a disease, but it's a different type of rickettsia type thing.
Oh, so it is a rickettsia, but it's not the same.
Lyme disease is every alternative American doctor's answer to every fever in the world. So they've got their own answer. It's like house's lupus. You know what I mean? Lyme disease is just an... We don't see it in South Africa, Lyme disease.
Okay, cool.
And if you do, it's very, very rare.
Yes.
Or you need to change your doctor.
Right, yellow fever. Why is yellow fever so dangerous?
So just to clarify that, yellow fever is very dangerous, but only a minority of patients. So that's when it progresses to what we call a toxic phase. So the virus then attacks vital organs, and it can cause severe liver failure, internal bleeding, kidney damage, and a high mortality rate of up to 50%. So the reason why it's so dangerous is because there's no specific cure. There's no antiviral medication to cure the disease once you're infected, and your medical treatment is essentially limited to supportive treatments. So it's got a rapid progression, and the actual disease can progress within hours. You get severe systemic damage. You get severe hemorrhaging, which bleeding from the mouth, the nose, the eyes, the stomach. You get multi-organ failure, but you get a yellowing of the skin and eyes, and the hallmark is jaundice. Mm-hmm. And that's a sign of the liver being compromised. And it's got an epidemic potential because it's transmitted by that day-biting Aedes mosquito. So the virus spreads quickly in highly populated areas with low community immunity, and it makes the major threat to public health. However, this disease is entirely preventable because a single dose of the yellow fever vaccine will offer safe, highly effective, and lifelong protection. So if you're going to an area if you're going to an area where there is yellow fever,
mm-hmm.
you have a yellow fever vaccine. Don't go to areas like that where you haven't had a vaccine.
Yeah, so I know that there were certain countries that I used to travel to in Africa where they wouldn't let you in unless you showed your yellow fever. I just thought it had a limited life, so that is really good news. Okay, which tropical infections are the most common in travelers?
So, I mean, your basic things like gastrointestinal infections, and that's what we call bacterial or traveler's diarrhea. And then that's followed by your vector-borne diseases, dengue, malaria, and of course your vaccine-preventable respiratory illnesses like influenza. And obviously the risk depends on your destination, the season, etc. So the traveler's diarrhea is E. coli and contaminated food and water, hepatitis A, which is a viral liver infection which spreads through contaminated water itself and food or close personal contact, as well as typhoid fever. With regards to your vector-borne, that we've discussed, that's dengue fever, malaria, and other things which we call chikungunya and Zika viruses. So those...
Well, we spoke about chikungunya recently.
Outbreaks
in
Africa. So yes. Those are spread by...
I was very worried.
The daytime biting mosquitoes. That's because you couldn't say the word chikungunya.
Chikungunya, yeah. I did practice.
And
but
they are your flu-like symptoms and joint pain. And they also are prevalent in similar tropical areas. And then there's something called leptospirosis, which is also common in your tropical climates. And that's also due to water-related activities or wading through floodwaters. And then, of course, obviously the influenza, because the flu circulates year-round in tropical and subtropical climates, and it's the most common vaccine-preventable illness amongst travelers.
What's sleeping sickness?
That's the one which has that's presented by the tsetse fly.
Right.
So that's trypanosomiasis. And you get fever, you can go into comas, seizures, so convulsions,
that's one of them that we have spoken about. Okay, we've only unfortunately got about 5 minutes left, but I just want to go through a couple of important things that I've jotted down here. Which travel vaccines are your most important?
So, I mean, I would say that the influenza vaccine, mm-hmm. the yellow fever vaccine, those are your most important vaccine.
Why has there never been a malaria vaccine?
So they're working on the malaria vaccine, and the malaria vaccine is in
testing,
in evolution. It's going to happen sooner than you think. So
I hope so, because that'll be very, very nice. And I mean, if there's a malaria vaccine and people actually take it, then there's a chance, I would imagine, we could actually eradicate malaria.
Yeah, I mean, that would be ideal. But the problem with the malaria vaccine is that, you know, there's a rapid replication of these pathogens. So these pathogens multiply exponentially in the bloodstream.
So it's unlikely we'll ever really...
I don't know if it's unlikely we'll ever really, but it is a possibility. But we've got a way to see. I mean, you know, you've got to stay up to date on your vaccines. It's very important, you know.
Yes. Should every traveler take malaria prophylaxis?
So that's something that's quite debatable because... if you're going to an area where there's no malaria, but it's like a tropical or hot area, then no. But I mean, if you're going to Kruger this time of the year and you are like there's rain and there's like high density malaria, the answer is definitely yes. I mean, for me, if you want to prevent the development of cerebral malaria and these type of things, then hell yes.
Look, I would take it even if I wasn't going. But how effective are mosquito repellents and bed nets?
Extremely effective because they're covered with, if they're used properly, they can prevent malaria. You know, that if you wear long sleeves at nighttime, if you do your tabards at nighttime, if you use these malaria nettings, which are tucked into the actual bedding with this DEET inside, which is antiparasitic, they are highly, highly effective.
Okay, and this is something I always wonder is, because I might do it myself, is why do we stop taking our malaria tablets too early, and what's the issue with that?
Sometimes it's due to side effects. Some people don't like the side effects they get from this dizziness or a bit of nausea, that type of thing. The other times people think that when they've left them the area malaria, they're no longer at risk. But if you realize that the malaria actually parasite is still replicating in your body and it's still replicating your liver, you realize that you need to take it for extended time while you leave the area.
Okay. And what simple precaution can dramatically reduce infection risk?
So washing hands. Hand hygiene is extremely important. You wash your hands with soap and water for 20 seconds. Use sanitizer. Avoid touching your face. Practice good respiratory etiquette, sneezing at your elbow, not your hands. You can sanitize high touch surfaces and stay home when you're sick and handle food carefully.
Right. And some quick myth busting ideas before we conclude. Malaria is just a bad flu.
No, it's not. I mean, it's a very dangerous myth there because it does share some of the symptoms with flu, but we know it's a life-threatening parasitic disease, which is spread by mosquitoes. It's not a virus, and it doesn't always resolve on its own. It can quickly escalate to organ failure and, if left untreated, death.
Okay, and things that every person should know. When should you urgently seek medical help?
Well, if you've got severe symptoms like neurological signs, confusion, difficulty arousing a patient, seizures, dizziness, cardiorespiratory distress, chest pain, severe shortness of breath, severe dehydration, dizziness, thirst, dry mouth, heavy bleeding that will not stop with direct pressure, signs of shock, fainting, loss of consciousness, allergic reactions where you get swelling of the lips or tongue, then you don't delay medical treatment.
Mm-hmm. And we've spoken about eradicating malaria. We've spoken about the importance of vaccines. And just one other question is, just out of interest, why tropical diseases are so strongly linked to poverty?
Well, once again, when there's raising of the temperatures in those climates where there's poor sanitation, where there's lack of medical support, these things are things. You said something earlier, malaria could be eventually eradicated. Mm. And that is true, because essentially we're hoping that with the rollout of the vaccines, there's an R21 matrix M and RTS vaccine, which could actually provide 75% of efficacy. And with that, we are a major game changer in preventing infections. There's new technologies which are looking at gene drives. Mm. There's targeted interventions. So those things can actually play a big role in helping with actually preventing malaria.
And that is unfortunately all we have time for. That was the weekly checkup with me and Dr. Anton Marburg. I'm Howard Feldman. Thank you for joining us.